Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, Kristen Esperland explores some Kentucky caves and reports on their environmental health. First, since the 2003 groundbreaking for the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage in Louisville's Russell neighborhood, the project has had funding problems, which halted construction in late 2005. This month, construction resumed, prompting Elizabeth Kramer to explore the intent behind the building.
Where Muhammad Ali Boulevard meets 17th Street, there are hints of activity. White pickup trucks come and go from the large brick buildings that long ago housed a repair shop for trolleys. Men in white hard hats work nearby. They won't let me in for a peek, but Christy McCravey, who is charged with fundraising for the center, describes what will be there.
You'll walk into a rotunda, which is like a little theater, and you'll see the ocean blue under your feet and the African skies over your head. And you'll hear the drums, because the drums are the symbol of Africa. And when you step out of that, you're going to step into an exhibit founded in the words of the Kentucky Constitution.
Those words, life, liberty, and property, are part of the story of African Americans who lived in this state and did not have liberty because they were considered property. But McCravey says the idea is to focus on education about the African American experience in Kentucky that goes beyond slavery.
Many of our youth are unknowledgeable of the experience of their ancestors. And with that brings a lack of pride for who you are and what you are. And we feel that this center can turn around many aspects of our community.
McCravey and local leaders want the center to tell the story about people's accomplishments. They see the center as a tourist destination, a community center, and with all that activity, an attraction for new businesses. Many neighborhood residents say they want it to be a source of inspiration for African Americans and others. That includes 89-year-old Lucia Leggett.
It's going to inspire the people who live in the neighborhood to have more pride in their neighborhood and in the city. And it will encourage other people in different localities in Louisville and outside of Louisville to come to see what has been accomplished and developed there.
To meet those expectations, McCravey still has to raise $3 million of a $5 million goal to open the center. Then another $1.5 million for the annual budget when the center is fully staffed in 2010. By then, the center is expected to have 50,000 visitors per year. It is trying to meet these expectations by working with schools, churches, and even the Smithsonian Institution. Deborah Mack has worked with Chicago's Field Museum and Cincinnati's National Underground Freedom Center. She says these relationships are key. She says it's just as important to be accountable to visitors and the community about programs and budgets. That way, the public will be ready to support fundraising efforts. All this has to be built around the main attraction, of course, which is competing with so many other forms of entertainment these days. Many of the newer cultural museums are doing that by depicting history in a distinct way. Deborah Mack.
The newest wave of museums, and I think this is a trend that's going to continue, sees African-American heritage and culture as part of the national story, and that in many ways we now feel that you cannot understand American history and culture in general without understanding the African-American input into that story.
Mack says successful centers include the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. Christy McCravey says one of the main lessons they've learned is that a cultural center needs an identity.
In spite of the strides that we've made, racism is not completely dead. We still have a long way to go. We still have one more river to cross.
And one more river to cross is the theme for the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage, tying the center to Louisville and its setting on the Ohio River. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Throughout Kentucky, human traffic and pollution have damaged caves and sinkholes, and that in turn has polluted the groundwater many end up drinking. Although some of these sensitive ecosystems are making a comeback, as Kristen Esperland reports, the caves remain vulnerable.
Tour guide Nancy Tony leads a group down into Horse Cave in the south central town of Horse Cave, Kentucky. She points over a railing at one of the two rivers tumbling below.
And this is the river that the sewage treatment plant was dumping the sewage into through that sinkhole. So the water that you see would have been black, those rocks would have been black, you would have been able to see clusters of bloodworms hanging to all of the rocks.
Today, the rivers run clear and clean, and the eyeless white crayfish that disappeared when pollution was killing the cave have made their way back. but it's been a long haul. Humans have been leaving their mark on caves for thousands of years. We've sheltered in them, we've told our stories on their walls. In the Prohibition era 1920s, locals even created an entire subterranean nightclub in one of Horse Cave's deep-set caverns, complete with orchestra and dance floor. But it wasn't until recently that people understood that what goes into a cave can come out the other end with consequences.
They're not just simply holes in the ground.
This is David Foster. He's head of the American Cave Conservation Association, which is headquartered right above Horse Cave.
They're holes that evolved because rainwater was moving through sinkholes and dissolving them and widening them and opening them. And that rainwater has to go somewhere. It doesn't just seep into the ground and continue to the center of the earth. It comes back out in the form of springs.
Foster says that if you contaminate a cave system, you contaminate the springs that emerge from the cave. And because those springs feed our rivers and streams, you're ultimately contaminating the water we depend on for drinking. Beneath about 40% of Kentucky's land is a geological formation called karst. It's basically limestone that water can easily dissolve, splitting open cracks, forming sinkholes, and eventually caves. Karst doesn't remove any impurities from water. It lets it pass right through. So Foster says that when he arrived in Horse Cave 20 years ago, runoff from homes and industry had taken their toll on the cave.
What we had was an open sewer in the middle of town.
And the pollution was edging its way into the nearby and better-known Mammoth Cave system. But money from the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Park Service helped build a regional sewer treatment system that went online in 1989. The cave got cleaner, but other groundwater contaminants were still causing problems.
Whenever it would rain, we would smell a gasoline odor. And then we went through a period where the EPA had a program removing all the underground storage tanks that had been leaking. After that got done, we almost never had that problem.
After years of environmental cleanup, the cave ecosystem has come back. But it will always be a delicate balance in a cave ecosystem, with only a few species depending on each other in this rare, sunless environment. It's easy to tip the scales. Rick Toomey heads Mammoth Cave Science and Learning Center. He says that, for example, aquatic cave animals rely on the organic material in water that seeps into the cave.
The cave fish, the cave shrimp, these organisms eat the organic material itself. We're very much dependent on that.
But they're also vulnerable for the same reason, because in with that organic material could also come toxins, poisons, pollution.
Household runoff is still potentially an issue. It's still an agricultural area. We have to make sure, work with people on best management practices, trying to reduce the amount of chemical usage.
Scientists at both Mammoth Cave and Horse Cave monitor groundwater constantly. But caves without national protection or vigilant conservation, caves all over Kentucky, are often still neglected. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
A memorial service for Kentucky civil rights activist Lewis Coleman was held Tuesday in the rotunda of the state capitol. Among those honoring Reverend Coleman, who died July 5th, were Governor Steve Beshear and retired Supreme Court Chief Justice Joseph Lambert. An audio montage of the event was produced by Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh.
The last time we were here together, we were arrested together. The governor had us arrested. We take no of his office. He wouldn't come out, so we take no of his office. And we spent about 8 hours in jail that particular day. You know, when you think about those times, and you look around and you see some of the younger generation, that's your reward. That's the price.
Standing tall with a bullhorn that resounds with thunder and lightning, to clear the way for civil rights and human rights.
Reverend Coleman certainly was no stranger to this building, as my predecessors can attest. As a protester, he was a voice that could not be silenced. As a volunteer, his energy had no limit. And as a human being, his compassion and empathy were great.
His persistence and determination to carefully examine the things that troubled him led to the establishment of procedures and to the monitoring of issues relating to racial fairness and to a broad awareness of those issues among judges, court officials, and members of the public.
Reverend Lewis Coleman, Jr. was a necessary irritant. He was a giant who may not have spoken with the poetry of a Dr. King, but spoke with a heart that would not be silenced and a voice that commanded the respect of all who heard him. He took up the cause of those who had no other voice. He got results.
For every mountain, you brought me over. For every one of my trials, you see me through.
Now, therefore, be it resolved. The Kentucky Commission on Human Rights does hereby express its gratitude for the life and leadership of Reverend Lewis Henry Coleman, Jr., and extends our deepest sympathies to his family.
He just really believed in what he was doing, and he believed in people, and he wanted to do the best for people, for what he did. He gave all he had, right up to the very end. He gave all he had, and it really kind of hurts me today that he didn't take better care of himself while he was caring so much for other people.
You see me through.
I know in time that the wounds will heal and we will live on his memory and on his legacy that he left for all of us. He was my friend. He was my friend.
Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear fielded questions from the public last week at the Louisville Forum. We'll bring you his answers when we come back. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, we'll learn more about the art and motivation of sculptor Joyce Ogden. First, Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear was in Louisville last week to participate in the monthly Louisville Forum. He spoke about the financial challenges facing the state and how his administration is trying to deal with them. After his address, the floor was open to questions from the audience, and here are a few of the questions offered by Louisvillians.
There's two that I'm going to lump together. One questioner wrote, the Kentucky government seems to be dominated by rural legislators. Why can't Louisville, Lexington, Northern Kentucky get their legislators together to get help for the urban areas? And another person wrote, I'm just so discouraged. What do you see as the realistic future legislatively of rural versus urban goals?
I think there's been a lot of change in the past few years, and particularly fairly recently in that whole process. And obviously, we do have that division to some extent. But I'm finding that there is more willingness to cooperate across those kinds of lines. Obviously, you are better off if you've got your whole Louisville delegation, and Lexington has its all of its delegation, and Northern Kentucky has its delegation, to bring a lot of pressure to bear to get some things done. But I think rural Kentucky does realize that unless Louisville, Lexington, and Northern Kentucky do well, the state is not going to do well. At the same time, I realize that part of my job, in addition to supporting Louisville, Lexington, and Northern Kentucky and making sure you do even better than you're doing right now, because that'll pull the whole state up, I've got a responsibility to get out into the other parts of this state and try to develop them into some type of economic engine also, because as they do better, this whole state will do better, and it will require less of your tax dollars flowing out to other areas than it does right now. Will Louisville and Jefferson County ever become, you know, a donee state instead a county instead of a donor county? No. You know, you all are the biggest economic engine we have. Northern Kentucky and Lexington are right there, there's always going to be some flow of money because a lot more tax dollars are produced here than any other place. There's going to be some flow into other areas. But the more I can create jobs and economic opportunity in other parts, in the more rural parts of the state, the better off the urban parts of the state will be in terms of keeping your own tax revenue.
Never jump over to the horse racing industry. How can we protect the horse racing industry? Please discuss casino gambling, slots at racetracks, and the safety of both the horses and the riders.
You talk about an industry that is approaching a crisis. Our horse industry is. Now, folks out here in the general public sometimes would listen to that and say, oh, come on, you know, it's just a bunch of rich people out there buying and selling horses and running them. Folks, this industry is much more than that. Obviously, at the top, there's 1% or 2% of the folks that are very wealthy that do it for fun. I mean, they want to make money too, but they do it for fun. They pay big dollars for these horses and all of that. But underneath that 1% are a tremendous number of people who are in this to try to make a living. They're not wealthy. There are a tremendous number of people who work at our tracks who make minimum wage, if that. And this is a big industry for Kentucky. And if we thought Toyota, who employs, I've forgotten how many thousands of people now, and has billions of dollars of investment in the state, if we thought that there was a chance that they would go under, we would be at their doorstep offering all kinds of incentives and trying to make sure that we kept Toyota in our state and going and employing those jobs. The horse industry overall in the state is much bigger than a Toyota or a GE or a Ford. It employs more people. There's more money involved in it in terms of the dollar turning over in our economy. It's a huge industry. But what we're allowing to happen right now is other states, who most of whom have done some kind of gaming, because that's where the money comes from, they have jacked their purses up so much at tracks out of this state. They have created breeders' incentive programs and owners' incentive programs, and our folks here in Kentucky right now who would rather race at Churchill Downs or Keeneland or Turfway or another one of our tracks, they're driving all the way to West Virginia because the purse is three or four times more, and they can't afford not to do it anymore. Some of the stallions that have traditionally stood stud in Kentucky are being moved out of this state because they're going to be moved into a state to where a breeder gets an incentive, gets money, additional money, if that horse is a horse standing in, say, Maryland or standing in some other state other than being in Kentucky. So all of this is happening right now, and it is threatening this business, and it's threatening this industry. There's not any easy answer to it, but we've got to find some way to make the racing industry in particular and the horse industry viable and continue to be viable in this state.
Do you have any plans to increase taxes this upcoming year?
Well, I just said we need more revenue. Actually, I'm just going to wave my magic wand. You know, I proposed actually two ways of raising revenue, each of which I think would be good for this state. And one of them I've just talked about with the idea of expanded gaming and putting that on the ballot and letting people vote on it. You know, the polls all indicate that about 80% of Kentuckians want to vote on that issue. Not all of them are for it, but they all want to have the right to express their own opinion. And I felt like that the legislature ought to at least allow them to do that. And so far, I haven't been able to convince them. But that's still an issue out there that is being discussed. The other thing I proposed was a 70-cent increase in the cigarette tax. Again, I proposed it for two reasons. One was because it will produce significant revenue. Will it solve all our problems? No, it won't. But it will certainly help, and it will help us in some of these areas where we're having to make reductions right now. The other good thing about raising the cigarette tax is that every study that you look at indicates the same thing, and that is it's probably the singular easiest and most effective way to improve health care with one stroke of the pen in this state. Every study indicates that if you raise the cigarette tax significantly, it cuts down on the number of people who smoke. It particularly cuts down on teenage smoking. Now, folks, I like to be number one in Kentucky in a lot of things, but there are some things that we're number one in or close to number one that we ought to be ashamed of. One of them is we're right up at the top in teenage smoking. Guess what? We're also right up at the top in diabetes, in cancer, in lung disease, in heart disease. You name the kind of chronic disease, and we seem to be right there. We're not taking care of ourselves the way we should, and part of it is because of the high rate of smoking in this state. That's not all of it, but it's certainly part of it. So I'm going to keep pushing to raise that cigarette tax for both of those reasons, and I'm hopeful that at some time in the future, we will get there.
That was the question and answer portion of last week's Louisville Forum with Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. There's more information on these topics at our website, WFPL.org. After several trips to the Middle East, sculptor Joyce Ogden began creating pieces that took on distinct themes. Now some of those sculptures are in an exhibit at Louisville's Cressman Center for Visual Arts called Dehydration. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Ogden about how she developed these pieces.
Originally, I was focusing on water, and as I continued to work with that concept, it became more about the absence of water. And so in this exhibit, there actually isn't any physical water. So I thought that the title should reflect that.
I know that a few trips inspired you in some of your work. Can you tell me about those trips and your experiences?
The first trip was in 1993, and it was in Egypt. And that was my first time going to that part of the world. And it sort of stayed in the back of my mind, and I never really addressed it or dealt with it in my work. But knew I wanted to and just figured sometime it would come up. And then I also had the opportunity in 2000 to go to Israel and then take a side trip to Jordan and was sort of rewoken by the sense of the desert and the dryness and the light and the issue of water. And I started thinking about water in a different way as opposed to earlier work where I was thinking about it as a fluid in the body, a fluid for the body, or even in a more kind of symbolic way, started thinking about it really practically and how water was used or accessed in the desert or in drier areas, and how as a civilization we access that water, make use of it when it's not there or have to get it from point A to point B.
Were there any specific experiences or places that you saw or people that you spoke to that started to crystallize the issues with water, especially in that part of the world?
Well, I picked up a book called Water Wars by Diane Rains Ward, and it's dealing with water management around the world. And so that really started to help me to focus on those issues.
Was there anything specific that you saw in terms of water projects or anything?
No, I didn't have it because I read the book after my travels, so I haven't really sought them out. Although they're right here as well around us, in Tennessee as well as every dam project here in Kentucky.
And what does the work look like?
They're large scale. They tend to be human scale or larger. Often they hang from the architecture, and so there's this relationship with gravity as well as with the architecture. I tend to work with what might be considered soft materials. I have a background in fibers, so I construct metal frames often and then work with very sheer fabrics that are then coated with polyurethanes, or I cast polyurethane, so there's often a very translucent quality and a play of light, also a play on the surface.
So in some ways, that's kind of like water playing with light on the surface. Is that one of your intentions with using the material in that way?
Well, the polyurethane is in a liquid state originally, and then it does solidify. So there is somewhat of a reference to its to the fluid and to water in its surface. And then I think the translucency can relate to water as well as to light and the play of light on water.
Besides the challenges that civilizations have in getting water, and especially potable water, are there any cultural or political themes in your work?
Not directly. When I started working on these pieces, it was the same time that we were going into Iraq. And so I was really focusing on and aware of what we were doing and the politics and the influence on our society as well as their society. And that just sort of was in the back of my mind as I was working on these pieces.
And how would you say they manifested themselves in the pieces?
Well, in one piece in particular, it's called Trayach. Originally, it was one form. It's kind of a chandelier-like form, quite large, and made of many small units that make up the chandelier. And originally, it was going to be one single chandelier, kind of amber in color. And as I was working on it, it didn't feel right that it be singular. It needed something else needed to happen. And I decided there needed to be two, that there should be a dialogue between two forms, two identical forms right next to each other. So I did a second form that was essentially darker, almost black. And so the two sort of juxtapose one another and create a dialogue of opposites, and yet they're equal.
And with this show, is this show going to be one of the largest of your work in town?
It is. There'll be four pieces in the exhibit. And the space is wonderful because it's large enough to allow for these large-scale works.
And how has your experiences actually producing the work affected how you're producing art now and what you're thinking about doing in the future?
Well, one of the pieces in the show, the most recent piece, which I'm still working on right now, is a response to something that happened with one of the pieces, saltation. In saltation, the sand sifts through the piece and then culminates on the floor below it. And as the piece does that, some of the sand drifts into the air. And in some installations, it would accumulate on a wall as perhaps maybe the airflow pulled it toward the wall. And I became really interested in that process and the effect that was created from the sifting of the sand. So right now, I'm sort of focusing on that movement and that process and the result that happens as the sand flows through or moves through a space.
So you're working with pieces that incorporate sand now?
Yes. As I focused more on the desert and the absence of water, I started replacing that with sand and then became very interested in sand as a medium.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Dehydration runs through September 20th at U of L's Cressman Center for Visual Arts. The Kentucky State Fair is underway in Louisville. Kristen Espelon spent an afternoon there and sent this audio postcard.
These are bantam fowl that we're looking at now, as opposed to the standard fowl, which is your full-size birds. Good quality bird. Leg color has to be a certain leg color and eye color. The comb has to be the right type of comb on them.
Got pulled pork, butterfly chicken breast, pork spare rib done on the smoker, baked beans, green beans, mac and cheese, potato salad, slaw, blackberry, and peach cobbler.
She's a Nubian. Her name is Peaceful Easy Feeling. She's first place in her class.
I am exhibiting cattle here at the Kentucky State Fair to show them tomorrow morning to see if they're good animals or they're not good animals. I have dairy cattle, I have Ayrshires, Guernseys, Jerseys, and Brown Swiss. This is an Ayrshire. Her name is Raspberry.
It's like a treat or a dessert? It's just good tasting. It's all great with caramel, everything, cherry, apple. Glazed. It's all in the sauce. We make our own sauce. That's the secret recipe.
You want to tell me what's in it?
No, not really. I might get skinned alive.
We showed yesterday and today, and it was really fun.
How'd you do?
We did pretty good. We won some stuff and lost some stuff, but we can't have it all perfect, so.
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with author Leslie Kagan about her new book, Land of 100 Wonders. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Oftentimes, novels can tackle topics too controversial for everyday conversation. Fictional characters are given more leeway to express their opinions or observations. The main character of the new book, Land of 100 Wonders, is no exception. Robin Fisher talked with author Leslie Kagan about developing a character with traumatic brain injury and how this frees the character from social conventions.
So your main character, Gibby McGraw, in A Land of 100 Wonders, has suffered a traumatic brain injury from a car accident.
Yes.
Did you have some trepidation having someone with this type of injury be your main character? I mean, it sort of reminded me of Icy Sparks and Gwen Rubio's novel, who had Tourette's. And it's sort of a, is it a delicate balance as to how to play this character?
I found, a whole gamut of things here. As far as traumatic brain injuries go, they do run from sort of mild and recoverable to really severe and non-recoverable. And I had a little experience. I had a friend who was in a horrible car crash and received a traumatic brain injury. Thank goodness hers was the rather mild and recoverable, at least I think it is. She doesn't. No, she wouldn't like me saying that. But my friend Chris, and so I knew a little bit about the process and what it would take to write in from that voice. I also felt that it was a very, very delicate balance for me. I found Land of 100 Wonders difficult. Because Gibby is who she is, and because her traumatic brain injury, or her not-quite-rightness, as her grandpa calls it, it was complicated to make sure that I remembered that there were certain things that she was able to do and certain things that she could not do, that she could remember and that she couldn't remember. That was the biggest challenge, I think, in writing the book, and making sure that she came off authentic. And not at all sort of me thinking what a traumatic brain injury person would act like.
Right, you know what I mean? Contrived.
Yeah, not contrived at all, but genuine. And I think all of us at certain parts of our life, or even certain times within the day, feel not quite right. And so I tried to focus very much on that feeling of having that feeling and what that meant to me and how it was difficult for me sometimes to figure the way things worked and how I would approach life and see it as such a big puzzle at times. So in many ways, it was easy for me to get into the voice of Gibby, but at the same time, I needed to keep that balance. It was really important to me.
Well, I found it to be really interesting because one of my favorite fictional devices is the unreliable narrator. But this is the first time that I have read a book where the narrator has been unreliable unintentionally.
Yes. She does try. She does not believe herself to be unreliable.
Right. And it is just as much a surprise to her when she remembers something as it is to the reader when they realize they don't have the full story.
Correct. Gibb operates from a place in within herself that is very positive, very can-do, admits that, yet yes, she has a hard time remembering words and their meanings, and her mind does wander more than God's chosen people. And she has some disinhibition, so she has a problem with cursing. And she knows those things. But she does not, in my sense, when writing her, does not actually see that as a deficit. She sees this as something that she has, just like she has a certain color hair and a certain color eyes. And it's something that she'd like certainly to work on. But I don't think at all that Gibby sees herself in any way as being disabled or unnormal.
Well, she's never self-pitying.
Never. That just would never, ever cross Kibbe's mind.
Which I think is interesting. And I think that one reason that that is believable is because her grandfather won't allow it.
Absolutely 100%. As she, there's a line in the book that said, you know, as Grandpa would say, go ahead and cry, nobody's listening. He's a tough Texas cowboy, and he's not going to put up with that sort of thing. He adores Kibbe. He would give his life for Kibbe, but he also has standards and a value towards life that's very particular in his own sense, in his own way. Grandpa has a sort of code of honor, and which he then, you know, sort of puts on to Kibbe as well. And I think she's happy to sort of take that on too. It gives her a sense of structure.
You tackle some pretty heavy themes in the book, but before we get to talking about those, I want to talk about the juxtaposition to the heavy themes and the humor, because the humor is sort of unexpected. It sneaks up on you. The first time that I laughed out loud was when she was working with her grandfather on one of her stories, and she made the comment that ever since she had put a photograph, an inappropriate photograph, in her newspaper, that her grandfather felt that he needed to review all of her stories.
Yes.
And it was a laugh-out-loud moment in the book.
I'm glad. I think Kibbe has, although Kibbe herself will tell you that she has no sense of humor anymore, that it's very difficult for her to understand jokes. She is hilariously funny, I hope, but in such a natural, unassuming, unforced kind of way. We find her funny. She herself does not see the humor in what she's doing. I think it's really important. I like to write about, I don't know if I'd call them heavier themes, but a little bit deeper stuff that I feel strongly about. And I find when I'm reading books that have a stronger and deeper theme, I don't like to be hit over the head. I like to have a little light touch. I think that it works better for me to see the difficulties in life through a sense of humor. I think it's the only way that many of us can transcend any kind of pain is to be able to step back and to see the humor in it. And everything that I write, Whistling in the Dark, my first book, I think the same sort of thing. I think it's partially my style and partially it is who I am as a human being coming in through the characters.
Well, you know, that sort of leads me to something else that I wanted to ask. You tackle the themes of race relations, Vietnam War, unwed motherhood, and let's just say the book is set in 1973, so these concerns are very immediate.
Yes.
Kibbe is able to say things about these issues because she is not quite right.
Correct.
That people listen to, but they would never say themselves.
I think that partially, one of the most wonderful things about Kibbe is that she's lost that filter that keeps us from saying things. In other words, Kibbe says the truth as she sees it. She does not have to worry about political correctness or saying something that might offend somebody, because I think also within Kibbe you sense such a deep, deep heart that and kindness and love that the things that Kibbe says are never mean-spirited, but they are honest as she sees them.
Now, you have another character in the book, Billy, who also has had, I guess what you would call a brain injury. It's more of an emotional injury from being in the war. He seems to be a much more wounded character than Kibbe.
Well, he's, I think if you look at all the characters within the book, there's not one person who you would call quite right. And I think that's part of the issue that I wanted to address. This whole sense of normal that I think so many of us try to live up to when we're all kind of struggling. It's hard. Life is hard. It's hard for all of us. And to constantly have this normal, this need to be normal or this need to fit into a specific place within life, it's hard enough to just kind of cope with everything that goes on within our daily life without having to meet that standard as well. And I this is my personal campaign, Robin. I just like everybody kind of just say, okay, you can just be whoever you want to be. I really like that idea. Maybe it's naive, but I've started to wear my pajamas to the grocery store in protest. I've decided, heck, I'm going to do kind of what I want to do as long as it's not hurting anybody. As far as Billy goes, Billy's suffering from what we know now as post-traumatic stress disorder after war. Many soldiers right now in Iraq are coming home with post-traumatic stress, and same as in Vietnam, but they didn't really have the label for it back then. Billy has a very hard time coping with what he's done in the Vietnam War and readjusting back to life in small town Cray Ridge.
In Cray Ridge, which is set in Kentucky.
Yes.
And why Kentucky?
Because I really like Kentucky, and I spent a bunch of time there when I was a child. I've been involved in the horse industry almost my entire life, and still have a horse. My daughter was involved in riding. I started riding when I was 7. And, you know, Kentucky got a lot of horses, and I really like it. It's so beautiful, and I cannot tell you how excited I am to get back.
Now, Cray Ridge is populated with quite a few characters.
Yes.
I don't want to leave the readers with the impression that it is this great little town where everybody's happy and Gibby's just not quite right. You have some pretty dark characters.
Yes, I do.
In this book.
Yes, I do. I've got Sneaky Tim Ray Holloway, who is Gibby's primary nemesis. Not a nice man, a predator of sorts. No, not of sorts, a predator. We also have the Brandish boys, who are a different sort of evil roaming about the hills. And then there's some little kind of a sly guy by the name of Willard, who is Gibby's temporary next-door neighbor in the cottage next to hers on the lake this summer. And I think all of them proved at one time to be a challenge, more than a challenge for Gib to handle. But once again, I think she does a pretty darn good job.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the Brandish boys, because they could almost be forgettable characters if they were better defined. I think by having them not quite so well defined, they are more nightmarish.
They're pretty scary to me. I'll tell you that right now. It's fascinating to me. When I set out to write a book, I have no idea what's going to happen in the book. I don't outline. I can't do synopsis. So I don't really know what's going to happen. When I first started to write Land of 100 Wonders, I thought it was going to be sort of this very kind of quiet, introspective type of book. But as I got along in it, I realized, boy, this just is not what's happening at all. This has turned into almost an adventure tale. And in fact, I think almost three-quarters of the book, as you know, the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid figures very strongly within the book. I think that the book itself almost becomes that kind of cowboy adventure story. And whereas they would be talking about a clever, Gibby's best friend, earlier on in the book, they actually begin to live it. And I think the Brandish boys are sort of the incarnation of the black-hatted bad guys of old.
I want to talk a little bit about the title of the book, Land of 100 Wonders, because I got sort of, I don't know, halfway through the book, and I thought, now why is this the title of this book? And it's interesting that Miss Lydia figures prominently in the book, but you don't meet her until the end, and you don't get to Land of 100 Wonders until the end.
Right. You know, I think that partially I like the idea of knowing about something but not seeing it. I think we get a clear picture early on about how important Land of 100 Wonders is to Gibby. But because of everything that happens to her within the story, she keeps trying to sort of make it to Land of 100 Wonders, but never gets over there because of everything so unexpectedly popping up. I also think that I like the concept of it being almost like heaven. It's something that we all yearn to see, yearn to be part of. And yet, none of us knows exactly what heaven is like or what it looks like. And then when it finally is revealed to Gibby, I think it's somewhat of a surprise to the reader. Were you surprised?
I was surprised.
Yeah.
But I didn't really have any idea what to expect, which I liked.
I'm glad. I think that you know it's a place of spirituality, but I don't think that the reader knows much more than that because they have to, once again, rely on Gibby for all the information that they get throughout the story.
And I will say that the twist in the book was a twist.
Thank you.
One more question. Of all of the characters in the book, do any of them have their own book waiting? Does anyone have their own story to tell?
You know, sometimes I wonder that, too. Sometimes I think, boy, I just like these characters in this book so much. I bet I could write another book about each one of them. Because I think that each one of them does have a story of their own to tell, and that each one of them could be taken off into another direction and given a deeper, more in-depth look at who they are and how they became who they are. God only knows how the Brandish boys became who they are. But I find that fascinating. That's a really interesting question. Somebody suggested to me, oh, well, you should make this into a series and have Gibby solving crimes, all, you know, like Nancy Drew kind of. And I said, well, gosh, I don't know. I don't really think in terms of that. I sort of just think, well, that's that story, and now I'm on to the next story. But I do think that there's still a lot to tell about Cray Ridge, so who knows?
Leslie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Robin.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Leslie Kagan about her new book, Land of 100 Wonders. Kagan will be reading from her book and selling copies Wednesday evening at 7 at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Lexington. For more information, go to our website, WFPL.org. The self-dubbed Happiest Music on Earth returns to Louisville next weekend. The annual Jug Band Jubilee will hold a day-long concert Saturday at Waterfront Park. So if you haven't seen someone play a jug in your life, now may be a good time to start. There's more information at our website, WFPL.org.
Way down south in Memphis, Tennessee, jug band music sounds so sweet to me. It sounds so sweet. Oh, it's hard to be.
So hard to be.
Jug band music certainly was a treat for me. Sitting down home, turned on my radio. Jug band music made me stomp down my floor. It sounds so sweet. Oh, it's hard to be.
So hard to be.
Jug band music certainly was a treat for me.
I took off my socks,
yeah.
And I took off my shoes,
uh-huh.
And I danced all night to the jug band blues because
it sounds so sweet. Oh, it's hard to be,
so hard to be.
Jug band music certainly was a treat for me.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM. which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Heldet. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.